Chapter 51. Hotel Schöne Aussicht Grossinger, Salzburg. Message from Evelyn Torres, Remy said, sitting down on the king-sized bed and kicking off her shoes. Just to call me. She sounded excited, though. She lives for this stuff. First, that brandy I promised you, then Evelyn, Sam said. We're going to need clothes and essentials. Brandy, Evelyn, sleep, then shopping. Since eluding Kolkoff on the Königssee, they'd been awake and on the move for over 28 hours. Heading south along the shoreline at a snail's pace, they reached the Obersee's Salat docks an hour later and disembarked. Sam opened the boat's scuttlecock, waited until a foot of water was sloshing on the deck, then pointed the bow toward the center of the lake and eased the throttle forward a notch. It disappeared into the snow. Remy said, "We haven't exactly been low-impact tourists, have we?" "Don't worry," he said with a wink. "We'll make an anonymous donation to the St. Bartholomew's Historical Society. They can buy a fleet of speedboats." From the docks they followed the gravel path inland for a half mile, then across the land bridge to the mouth of the Obersee proper, where they found another boathouse similar to the one at St. Bartholomew's. This one, however, had an adjacent warming room. Inside, they stripped down to their underwear, draped their clothes over coat hooks on the wall, and then found a kerosene lantern around which they huddled until nightfall when Sam started a small fire in the wood stove. They spent the remainder of the night curled together around the stove, then rose at 8:30, donned their clothes, and waited for the day's first boatload of tourists. They intermingled themselves with the crowds, strolled about for a few hours, and kept their ears tuned for any discussion of gunshots the previous day or a floating body having been found in the lake. They heard nothing. At noon, they took the boat back to Schönau. Once ashore, they decided to err on the side of slight paranoia and not return to the hotel. Nor would they use their rental car. Watchful for Kolkoff and his men, they ducked into the nearest gift shop, then out the back door into the alley. For 20 minutes they picked their way away from Schönau's waterfront until they found a cafe on a secluded side street, where they called Selma. At 2 o'clock a Mercedes from a Salzburg car service pulled up before the cafe, and 3 hours later, after a scenic drive, during which Remy and Sam watched for signs of pursuit, they checked into the hotel under the names Hank and Liz Truman. Fed and warmed by the brandy, they first emailed Selma the photographed symbols from the St. Bartholomew bottle, then dialed Evelyn Torres at home. "So why the sudden interest in Xerxes and Delphi?" Evelyn asked over a speakerphone after a bit of small talk. "Just a little project we're working on," Remy replied. "We'll fill you in when we get home." "Well, to answer your questions in order, at the time of Xerxes' invasion, Delphi was arguably the most sacred place in Greece. The Pythia's predictions were sought for everything, from matters of state to marriage and everything in between. As for treasure, there wasn't much there of tangible wealth. A few treasuries, but nothing compared to the riches of Athens. Some scholars disagree, but I think Xerxes didn't understand Delphi's place in Greek culture. From what few oral histories I've read, he considered the oracle a novelty, like a modern-day Ouija board. He was convinced the Greeks were hiding something at Delphi." "Were they?" "There have always been rumors, but there's no solid evidence to support them. Besides, you know the history. Xerxes' raiding party was turned back by the divine hand of Apollo, in the form of a well-timed rock slide. A few Persians got through and made off with ceremonial objects, but nothing of importance." Sam asked, "Did anything of value survive the invasion?" "The ruins are still there, of course. Some of the columns from the treasuries are in the Delphi Museum, as are some pieces of altars, stone friezes, the omphalos. No gold or jewels, if that's what you're asking." "Do you remember anyone ever nosing around about Delphi when you were there?" Remy asked. "Anything unusual?" "No, not really. Just standard research requests from universities, for the most part. Evelyn paused for a moment. Wait a second. There was this one guy about a year ago. He was from the University of Edinburgh, the School of History, Classics, and Archaeology, I think. Weird character. How so? He'd applied for a permit to examine the Delphi artifacts, and we granted it. There are rules for hands-on examinations, things you can and can't do with the objects. I caught him breaking one of the biggies, or almost breaking one, that is. I walked in on him trying to do some kind of acid test on one of the columns. Which columns? Remy asked. The Caryatides. They stood at the entrance to the Siphnian treasury at Delphi. Before either Remy or Sam could ask the next question, Evelyn answered it. A Caryatide is a stone column, usually marble, in the shape of a robed Greek woman. The most recognizable ones are at the Athens Acropolis. What kind of test was he trying to do? Sam asked. I don't remember. He had a jeweler's hammer and pick and some kind of acid kit. I put it all down in my report to the board. I may still have a copy. Let me look while we talk. They heard Evelyn moving about, then the rustle of cardboard and the shuffling of paper. Remy asked, What did he say when you caught him? That he'd misunderstood the rules, which was bunk. I gave him the rules myself. He was lying, but he refused to say what he was up to. We ejected him and notified the guy's department chair at Edinburgh. No police? The board decided against it. Lucky for him, too. The Greeks take that kind of thing seriously. He would have done jail time. I heard Edinburgh fired him, though, so that's something. I don't know what happened to him after that. Here's the report. His name was Buckland. Thomas Buckland. And the acid kit he had? Sam asked. The sound of flipping pages came through the speaker. This is strange, Evelyn said. I'd forgotten this part. He was using nitric acid. Remy said, Why is that strange? It's not a standard artifact test. It's highly corrosive. We don't use it. Who does? Sam answered. Metallurgists. It's used to test for gold. They talked for a few more minutes, then hung up. Sam opened his MacBook Air, one of the few things they'd brought along in his backpack from Koenigsee, and logged into the hotel's wireless internet connection. There were almost 2,000 hits for the name Thomas Buckland. It took only a few minutes to narrow their search to the right one. Buckland's written a number of papers on classical history, mostly focusing on Persia and Greece, but nothing more recent than a year ago, Sam said. About the time he got fired, Remy said, looking over his shoulder. Are any of his papers available? Looks like JSTOR has them all. JSTOR was a non-profit online archive for scholarly work whose subjects ranged from archaeology and history to linguistics and paleontology. Sam, Remy, and Selma used the site extensively. I'll have Selma download and forward them. Sam typed up a quick email and sent it. Selma responded 30 seconds later. 5 minutes. Remy asked, Any mention of what he's been up to since leaving Edinburgh? Nothing. Sam's email chimed. Selma had found 14 papers by Buckland. They were included as PDF attachments. Here's something interesting, Sam said. According to Selma, Buckland had been on a sabbatical from Edinburgh when he showed up on Evelyn's doorstep. So he was freelancing, Remy replied. He wasn't there on behalf of the university. Who the heck is this guy? Sam stopped scrolling, his fingers frozen over the keyboard. He leaned closer to the screen and squinted. There's your answer. Have a look. Remy leaned over his shoulder. One of Buckland's papers included a photo of the author. It was small and in black and white, but there was no mistaking the mostly bald pate, fringe of orange hair, and black-rimmed glasses. Thomas Buckland was the lab-coated man they'd encountered in Bondurk's private laboratory.